Are you ready for the quantum age?
Humanity's next step in evolution?
Dream Vision 7 Radio Network invites you to the extraordinary platform of evolutionary voices for the quantum age.
Let's explore. Learn more about this upcoming age where we bridge science with spirituality.
Where potentiality meets reality.
Where we take compassion into action.
Our trailblazers and visionaries will ask the whys, the what ifs, while igniting continuous possibility.
Come along with us into an age beyond what we know today, where we can grow together in unity consciousness.
Experience evolutionary voices for the quantum age, Monday through Friday at 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. Eastern on DreamVision7Radio.com.
Welcome to the Lifeboat Hour with your host, Carolyn Baker.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost.
Welcome to the new Lifeboat Hour on the first Monday in March, as once again here in North America, we've broken records for the hottest February ever, and we'll see how many climate records we break in March. And of course, climate records are broken somewhere on the planet every single day with runaway climate chaos. Climate chaos, which most of humanity is unwilling to deal with on any significant level. And so it's always refreshing to have a guest on the new Lifeboat Hour who totally gets our predicament in the way that my guest does today. And more importantly than just getting it, I love hearing the stories of folks who not only get it, but are reinventing their lives in order to serve something besides their own comfort and safety. Myrna in Paris, as she's known on Facebook, or Myrna Lorraine Hussey, as she is known to the Canadian government, has not held down a regular job for close to 15 years. She has instead been practicing her own brand of radical democratic mothering with her three kids, and she's been a burden on the system, and she's been a free-range intellectual since she dropped out of grad school in 2003. Myrna thinks this has given her the kind of freedom to explore ideas, learn new skills, and contemplate life on Earth that few other humans are privileged to do in this culture. For most of us, modern life is a run until you drop, debt-enslaved festival of stress, and Myrna has been able to make use of her luck, she says, in being marginalized and disabled to follow an unusual and much more gentle path, one she hopes is leading her gradually away from the planet-killing and suicidal one on which most people now find themselves trapped. She's been on a journey of collapse and climate chaos awareness for some time, and also it sounds like an inward journey, which we're going to talk about on this podcast. And it's a great pleasure to welcome you, Myrna in Paris, to the new Lifeboat Hour. Welcome.
Thank you, Carolyn, and thanks for inviting me to join you.
Well, you're very welcome. And, you know, you have a blog post called Abundant Descent, which I didn't know about until we started talking about doing this podcast. So would you give us the web address of that blog? Because you've written some really powerful articles on it.
No, thank you. It's Abundant Descent, and descent is D-E-S-C-E-N-T, at wordpress.com.
Abundant Descent, D-E-S-C-E-N-T, at wordpress.com.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Yeah, check it out, folks. There's some good stuff on there. Now, Myrna, you've made quite a journey, which, like all of us, you're still on, with regard to the collapse of civilization, and it's been leading you to the awareness of potential human extinction, and I'd really like you to talk about that journey and tell us what you've experienced and where you feel you are on the journey today.
Okay, I would say that this started for me totally accidentally. I was given a birthday present, actually, which was a Netflix subscription. And I started watching documentaries. And there were so many good documentaries. The End of Suburbia was on. There were a couple of good ones about water wars. I think there was something about soils, something about climate change. I just started watching all these documentaries, and it occurred to me, having watched about, I don't know, six of them in about the first two or three days, that these problems were coming together in ways that not a lot of people were seeing.
Right.
Very few people were seeing. So if somebody was concentrating on the water problem, for example, they would come up with a whole lot of solutions. And often those solutions would be in conflict with, for example, the soil problem.
Right.
Or with climate change, or with peak oil. Peak oil in particular.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the problem solving that we modern Western humans do depends heavily on there being fossil fuels for us to use to do these solutions with. And I don't think that's the case.
Mm-hmm. Well, so you watch these documentaries and then what happened?
Well, I don't just watch, right?
Right.
That's just not my idiom. So I doubted everything and everybody.
Good.
So I Googled everything and I Googled everybody and I followed up their version of events with things they'd written as well as just blurbed out in a documentary. And then I went looking for the opposite opinion. So I studied peak oil maybe for 8 months. Just completely obsessed with peak oil. I watched everything I could find about peak oil, pro and con, and then I decided that what the peak oil guys were saying made a lot more sense than anything that was being said to debunk them. I did the same with climate change. This is how I do research.
And so where did that lead you? I mean, you knew all this stuff, but then where did that lead you?
It was overwhelming. For one thing, it led me to understand in a way that I hadn't. The assumptions that I was making and that I had always made, places where I had put my heart into anti-oppressive politics, for example, I did not know how deeply I had bought into the progress narratives of my society.
Yes.
I really believed, and I hadn't really been conscious about how deeply I believed this, we were all going to end up in Star Trek The Next Generation.
Uh-huh.
That's where this was going. I knew that there were long battles ahead of us. I hadn't had illusions about any of that for a long time. I'd been an anarchist a long time. I understood that all of these battles were going to be battles, but I absolutely believed we'd win. We'd win them all. We'd win all the battles of class and race. There would be no heterosexism left anymore. There would be no ableism left anymore. We would just make it. Yeah.
And then?
and then I had to let go of all that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was hard. And actually, I was in therapy and had been in therapy. One-on-one for 5 years. I've done other things too, but this one particular relationship fell apart because of this. And that's when I also, in looking at peak oil, came upon your work, and I came upon the work of a psychologist named Kathy McMahon.
Right.
And the two of you helped me enormously because I reacted just like everybody else reacts. I reacted with, I got to get out of here. I have to change everything. I have to go. It's gonna collapse on my head any minute. Right? And you were saying, you know, calm down.
Well, not exactly.
Don't run. No, but you were saying, you know, just take your time. And also,
yes,
you gave so much good guidance to me in those early days about handling relationships.
Uh-huh.
And I, you know, realized I had to pull back from just screaming in everybody's face all the time about this, you know, because when you understand this situation that we're in, it feels like you are in a house on fire.
Mm-hmm.
And the human instinct is to go wake everybody up and that you love and drag them out of this burning house and to flee yourself. And so that it was, I had to fight all of that at the same time as I was just trying to come to terms.
Yeah. And You know, it seems like everyone I speak with who's on this journey has a similar experience of feeling like they're in a house on fire and everybody else is sleeping. And so I describe it as a schizophrenic kind of experience where you feel like you have one foot in two different worlds, you know. There you are, you're walking in these two different worlds. And that's part of what my work is about, is helping people hold that, helping people do that walking in both worlds. And you were able to come out of that tailspin and find your legs and your footing. And, you know, your story about the documentaries, very similar to mine, because no, I'd been an activist and anarchist and looking at the underbelly of things since I knew Mike Rupert way back in the early 2000s. Yeah. And yet, I did not have that sense of putting things together as you were describing. Now, what did it for me was a documentary called What a Way to Go, Life at the End of Empire, which you probably saw. And I was able to stop looking at peak oil here and imperialism there and climate change over here and put this all together and go, oh my God, industrial civilization is collapsing and the paradigm on which it rests is collapsing. And so my first thought, and we're talking probably 2008, my first thought was, well, what are people going to do emotionally? That's because of my training as a therapist. You know, there are all these hundreds of websites where you could go and learn about how to prepare, you know, what to do here and logistically there, but nothing about how people are going to take care of themselves emotionally and spiritually. And so you went on that journey to find out, and then I went on a journey of writing a book called Sacred Demise, which helped me find out and helped many other people find out who read it. So anyway, then it sounds like one of the next steps was becoming much closer to nature and the earth. And you fondly say these days that you are going down gardening. And I'd like you to comment on what you mean by that and also talk to us about one of your cherished role models, a man in Aleppo named Abu Ward, Father of the Flowers.
Yes, okay, I will talk about that. So I told you about my collapse experience. I found Guy McPherson.
Yes.
And I watched everything he did for years and years on end, and I joined a number of communities where near-term human extinction was discussed. And that was a huge, that took even longer to process, actually, I have to tell you. And that's, you asked me earlier, where am I on the journey? Mm-hmm. I am still processing that. But yes. I am convinced that it is not actually possible to entirely process, that mm-hmm. we have wiped out our own species, partly by our own hands.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, but that we're taking large swaths of the planet with us when we go down.
Yes.
It is, I struggle to imagine what could be larger than that,
mm-hmm.
that a human could possibly ever try to cope with. So in my struggle to cope, I was really lucky that I already had gone through the collapse bit. I already had collapse ideas. I had already found the solutions that I felt I could follow through on, which were around permaculture, largely. My grandparents bought a farm when I was 5 years old. So the happiest days of my childhood were spent on that farm.
Nice.
So my inclination was to go farm.
Mm-hmm.
For that reason. My connection with nature has always been there. Right? I mean, wandering around on that farm alone, I had so much time to do that.
Right.
Just wandering around with the dogs, all four seasons, you know, and so that connection with nature has always been there for me, even when I lived in cities. So that was the natural thing for me to do. That was my choice, right? Other people reacted in very different ways, and they had very different ideas. And I found myself at times feeling like I needed to defend the idea that I was going to keep gardening, that I was going to keep planting trees. So my partner and I had been planning this, but we had been planning it a little later because my son is only 14 and totally addicted to computers.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And he's homeschooled, and the computer is a huge part of his homeschooling. So we all had to work together to figure out a plan that would work for all of us. So what we're going to do is we're going to move to the farm actually in a few weeks from now. We are going to bring in hydro so that my son can continue to use the computers. And he is aware that when he turns 18, that becomes totally his responsibility. It's no longer our job.
Uh-huh.
That's the deal we worked out. There was a story out of Aleppo when there were so many stories coming out of Aleppo. The propaganda around Aleppo was horrific there for a while. Mm-hmm. Everybody wanted to use Aleppo for their own reasons. And I saw a documentary, a little mini documentary. It was very short, about a man named Abu Ward, who was a gardener. He owned a garden center in East Aleppo. And the documentary had been filmed with a slant where he was just talking about how wealth didn't matter, how his wealth was in the dirt, how growing things was what mattered to him. He wasn't interested in being wealthy. And they're asking him, why aren't you leaving? And he's saying, because Aleppo needs flowers now more than ever. Mm. And they talked to people who came to him and would buy flowers from him. They would go to bombed out areas in Aleppo, tear out the rubble and put flowers in. And that to me is part of the spiritual journey through this, a really important part.
Yes.
We need to hold on to what is beautiful, what is joyful. We know that the planet is dying. We know that the biosphere is collapsing, but there are still trees. There are still flowers. It is still alive.
Yes. Yes.
And we are still alive. Mm. And being alive is an opportunity to take pleasure in all of that and in one another.
How beautifully said, Maren. Thank you so much for that. Oh. Yeah, you're speaking my heart as well. And at the same time that we need to really treasure and cherish that beauty, we have to also be aware of the shadow. And you speak very openly and clearly about the importance of doing shadow work. So I'd like to know what the shadow means to you, first of all, how you define it, and also talk to us about how that work has impacted your life, both in the past and in the present.
Okay, so my story is a little bit unusual in that I had multiple traumas in early childhood. That doesn't happen to everybody. So I have no memory of a child self or an adult self that wasn't already traumatized.
Mm.
So the way I dealt with that was to be very much in my head most of the time.
Yes.
And to be very, very busy. So I the only chemical addiction I've ever had was to cigarettes, mm-hmm. luckily for me. But I could get addicted to any kind of behavior, people I could get addicted to. And I eventually, running, fell down because nobody can run ahead of their own feelings forever. And so I had what would be called a nervous breakdown once upon a time, and I still like that terminology for myself, actually.
Right, right.
It was I had my own personal private psychological collapse,
mm-hmm.
at which point I still had children, and one of them was very young, mm-hmm. 2 years old, and I needed to not be in that state of total collapse. I needed to find a way to care for him and to be there for my kids. So that was all the motivation I had. And I started doing work to heal the trauma. And work to heal trauma means that you have to go and re-experience all of the trauma.
Yes.
And I had so much trauma.
Mm-hmm.
This is why it was such a very long, difficult process for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I think... I know for myself, from inside myself, I know where my bad behavior comes from.
Mm-hmm.
When I am acting out unlovingly, uncompassionately, and with cruelty or selfishly, I know that that's coming from deep inside me in fear places, mm-hmm. where I feel like I have nothing and I'm furious. But I also know that most of that acting out was totally unconscious.
Yes.
For decades, I was acting out what the big book calls a tornado through the lives of others.
Yes, yes.
That is how I was, without understanding it, without being able to see it, without consciousness, really. So to me, shadow work means stopping. However hard that is, and finding whatever support is needed to stop, because sometimes some of us need an awful lot of support to stop. And going inside ourselves and really honestly looking at ourselves, allowing all the feelings that we feel to come up, acknowledging the thoughts that are there. And it's only through that process of looking at the stuff inside ourselves that we really want to deny, either because it's too painful or because we feel too ashamed.
Mm-hmm.
And if we cannot get over that shame and accept ourselves as we actually are, we can't do that for other people.
And you know, one thing you didn't mention, but I know you know this, is if we don't deal with that shadow, what we will do is project it on other people.
This is what I mean by my bad behavior.
Uh-huh.
This is precisely the thing.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, we see it in another person. We see something inside of us. We think we're seeing it in another person. And sometimes there's some reality to that and sometimes there isn't.
Right.
So some selfishness, some denial that we're clinging to, I don't know, whatever it is, a bad behavior pattern, for example, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it infuriates us. We become enraged. We attack. We cannot help but attack, because what we really want to attack is what's in us.
Yes.
We hate this thing that's in us.
Yes.
When we see it outside or think we see it outside, we want to kill it. Because it brings it up in us. It threatens to come up in our consciousness.
And I have found for myself and for most people I've worked with around shadow material is that as we can own the shadow in ourselves, it tends to improve our relationships. Not always, not in every case. But it does tend to make our lives a bit more harmonious. Certainly for me, I've noticed it's created much more compassion and much more empathy.
Yes.
And realizing that there, but for the grace of something or other, I would be walking in those shoes myself.
Precisely.
And in knowing that this person's in their core sacred self is not meaning to do this. But there's another part of them, a very wounded part of them in their shadow that is doing what they're doing.
Yes.
So I don't see how any of us can prepare emotionally for the incredibly worsening future that we're going to be going through, the craziness, the madness of our planet, without doing very deep shadow work.
And few people do it. Because my experience tells me few people do it because it's so painful and difficult.
Yes. Yeah.
So the people who do it tend to have good reason, like no alternative but to do it.
Well, sometimes we have to have our backs so up against the wall that we can't move, and that's the only option, and it's do shadow work or die, you know.
Correct. That was
much like where the situation we're in the planetary predicament, evolve or die.
Yeah. And I know people from Facebook who precisely did exactly that. They came upon this collapse narrative. They came upon the NTHE narrative, and then they suddenly got spiritual. They went looking.
Mm-hmm.
They live their whole adult lives without being a spiritual seeking person in any way, with no religion, no concern for any of those issues. Well, they found themselves crushed by this understanding, and then went out and did the work at that time. And that is beyond me to understand, because
well, I'll tell you, the moment, the nanosecond that you begin to talk about extinction, you are no longer in intellectual scientific territory. You are in existential territory. It's the reason Guy and I wrote the book together, Extinction Dialogues, because with that science, you have to have some kind of, we live in a culture that is obsessed with happiness. Don't worry, be happy, we sing. And yet our happiness is circumstantial and can easily be undermined when things aren't going our way. All of the great spiritual traditions have taught us that happiness is not the same as joy. And they have shown us how to access the deep core of joy that resides within our being. My dear friend Andrew Harvey and I have recently released a beautiful book entitled Return to Joy, in which we not only clarify the difference between joy and happiness, but provide tools for accessing joy no matter what is occurring in our lives. Return to Joy is a compelling and potent invitation to the reader to consider that joy is the ultimate nature of reality, and that its absence lies at the root of our current unprecedented global crisis. In this book, Andrew and I mine the mystical wisdom of the ages that places joy at the core of our existence and purpose as a species, moving forward to consider in depth the myriad enemies of joy in our time. As we tend the fires of joy, we celebrate its seven flames and nurture its ubiquitous presence, whether in the background or the foreground of our lives. Return to Joy is available on Amazon, the Barnes & Noble website, and through your local bookseller. Spiritual path or some kind of existential meaningful reality to integrate with all of this very daunting, dire information. Otherwise, you will go crazy. And I know people who've really gone over the edge because they couldn't handle it. So good on you for having that path, and good on the people on the near-term human extinction groups who are also going within, because that sort of thing really does force us to go within.
Yes, absolutely. And it is vitally important that people have support.
Absolutely. We cannot deal with the collapse of civilization or climate chaos or extinction or any of those without support. To think we can do it alone is madness.
It is madness. We are not individuals. This is the madness of this thing we called Western civilization.
Yes, yes.
But it this imagines that we are individuals.
Yes.
But humans are social animals. We have been social animals since before we were primates. Do you know?
And you know, the word that comes to mind as you're saying all of this is interbeing.
Yes.
You know, we need to move from the paradigm of separation to the paradigm of interbeing. We are connected with every living being.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We need one another. And we process socially. I think that's the other truth,
yes.
Right? That,
yes.
That this culture in particular, I think for the first time in human history, there is denial around that. Mm-hmm. There's this idea of intellectual property rights and that people have ideas.
Right.
Right.
So right, absolutely.
They come up with these ideas from who knows where, when really that is always a social process.
Yeah.
Always. It can't not be.
So today I'm speaking with another guest who is wide awake to our planetary predicament and is responding by living her life accordingly. Marinyn Paris is my guest today, and I want to get back to our juicy conversation. So lifestyle-wise, Marin, you and your partner are doing some very interesting things. You mentioned the farm as a result of your awakeness to the global crisis. So if you would, tell us a bit about these projects, and also if people want to get in touch with you, how do they do that?
Okay, I'd love to talk about this. This is one of my favorite topics.
Great.
So my parents bought a 98-acre property in Ottawa Valley when I was a child, mostly because I was harassing them about that, because all I wanted was to live in the country. We never did move there, and I have never throughout my adult life managed to move there, but I am moving now. And this house that I live in Paris, Ontario, is sold now, and we have to be out of here by April 10th, which means we have to be up at the farm in mid-April, when there may still be snow on the ground, so that could be challenging and interesting. The plan for this 98-acre property, now it has been in either grain, monocrop grain and cattle rotation, or just being grazed by cattle for decades now. Mm-hmm. Probably 5 decades, something close to that. I am going to rejig that. So my plan is to reforest most of the landscape. Mm-hmm. Now, about half of that would be wild forest. So I will mostly leave the sections of forest to just expand outwards into fields, for the most part in those wild areas. But in other areas, I'm going to be more intentional about planting food forests. So one of the things that we're doing all this on a shoestring budget, by the way, we did sell our house and we do live in this ridiculous real estate bubble that's still up in Canada.
Right.
But we don't have enough that we can just go and do set up a high-end operation or anything like that. So my plan is to grow most things from seed, to go find small trees, little seedlings in the forest that are in spots where they could not possibly maintain themselves, and bring them and put them on the landscape in the cleared areas. Mm-hmm. The land is just south of the boreal forest, and that land wants to be forest. When those fields are abandoned, as they often are now around there, they go back to forest. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping to speed that process up, and I'm also hoping to bring in some plants that normally wouldn't survive in Ottawa Valley because of the cold temperatures. I'm hoping to bring some in, some seed and some plants, and nurture them carefully so that hopefully as everything warms up, there'll be plants there that might survive.
Right.
Now, am I pretty sure this is going to work? No.
Right. None of us is.
No. But I made peace a long time ago with this. It's the serenity prayer. I'm going to do what I can do, mm-hmm. and try and cultivate some serenity around what I can't control.
Yes, absolutely.
So I can provide, I can plant. My back is still good enough that I can do that. I can save seed. I can plant specifically knowing that bees are in trouble there. The pollinators are in trouble. I can plant knowing that the barn swallows, which used to just be everywhere in that area, are almost entirely extinct in that area now. So I can build and I can plant to bring in insects for the barn swallows. And I can also, because it's 98 acres, I can make space for other people.
Yes.
There are people who want to do what I'm doing, who find themselves in the kind of position I was in. I was on disability and living in public housing when I found out what was going on. Mm-hmm. And my prospects for getting out of the downtown core of Toronto, which is a huge city, mm-hmm. were very slim.
Yeah.
They look different now, and I recognize the privilege because of the position I had been in before. So I want to offer other people an opportunity who are like-minded and interested in the same kind of project to come and share that land with us and help us reforest it.
Well, talk to us a little bit about service, because I know that service is important to you, and just anything you'd like to say about it.
Okay, well, the first thing I have to say about service is if you think that you're not serving this Gaian organism, you're deluding yourself.
Say more, please.
Because this is, if you step back and look at this biosphere as a single organism, and if you have any knowledge of evolutionary history, if you have any knowledge of what's gone on this planet, then what is very clear is that ecosystems call different species into being to fill their niches and their needs. And this is a beautiful orchestra of life on the planet. And it's been rebooted already 5 times, and now we're about to reboot it again. This planet is determined to stay alive, it would seem. Anyway, we're only here because we have served Gaia. We wouldn't still be here. 99.something% of species have gone extinct. That's because they ceased to serve.
Yes.
They no longer fit. When we are unfit, we shall be gone. Which is why I think we are going extinct, by the way.
Yeah.
A lot of people believe they've done the climate science and they've crunched the numbers and they believe just the climate can take us out.
Right.
And I believe that's looking increasingly likely.
Mm-hmm.
Increasingly soon. But for me, the bottom line is, if Gaia wants us here, and I'm using this, I'm personifying her, and I don't know to what degree that's justified, but if the planet wants us here as a species doing work for it, we'll be here.
Mm-hmm.
And when the planet has no use for us anymore, mm-hmm. we'll be gone.
Yes.
And it looks like that's what's happening now to me, that we have ceased to serve the overall system and have somehow become an organism that's running roughshod over the entire planet, which is remarkable and unique almost in the history of the planet. Although yes. apparently, way back in the day, the very first mass extinction was caused by some organisms that were producing toxic gas called oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And killed off a lot of other organisms. So it's not entirely unprecedented, but it's not pleasant to be a member of that species.
Certainly not on this scale.
No.
Yeah. Service, we can't emphasize it too much. That is part of why we're here, not just to create joy and beauty, but also to serve.
So the thing I've said is that you can't not serve, and it's true. The plants are going to eat you, no matter what you do. The microbes and plants shall eat you.
Yeah.
But we're really lucky, actually, because we're the only species that we know of that can anticipate, study Gaia, anticipate her patterns, understand her patterns well enough to actually be conscious, intentional assistance to her. That is a way that humans uniquely, I think, can be of service according to what we know now.
Yes.
Everything serves Gaia, but uniquely we can be intentional about it.
Yes. Yes.
For me, understanding my part in this, and I have a systemic view, so I don't shame myself or hold myself responsible for everything that's happened in some way. But I have had a part. My life has been a consuming life.
Yes.
And I just want to be of more service to her.
Yes.
For the rest of my life.
Mm.
That is what I want. Not only her. This is for my children.
Uh-huh.
This is for everybody else's children. And I don't just mean the human ones. I mean all of the children.
Yes.
Everything that is currently struggling now on this planet to reproduce. There's so much work to do. No, and I guess anyone who has any desire to do social justice work can be more than busy enough with that.
No kidding.
And I've always been called to do that. But I see this ability to replenish this small piece of land, hopefully share some of those skills locally if anyone's interested, and actually receive refugees.
Mm-hmm. So how can people get in touch with you, by the way?
They can get in touch with me on Facebook by sending me a private message. I am Myrn in Paris.
That's M-Y-R-N, and then in Paris.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, they can do that. They can also email me through my blog, which I gave earlier, Abundant Descent.
Uh-huh.
That's also, I also have an email address, abundantdescent@gmail.com. And that's descent as in going down.
Yes, descent. Yes.
Right.
So as we come down to the end of our time together, do you have any additional thoughts you'd like to share?
I think the major thing that I would like to share is that anything that we can do to be kinder to ourselves when everything is falling apart is work well done. Because when we are kind to ourselves, when we feel full, when we feel loved, when we are willing to be kind and compassionate with ourselves, this allows us to do it for other people, and it allows us to be of service. And that appears to be what life is about, being of service to one another. And it's a joyful thing. It's not a drudgery.
Well, as the Dalai Lama says, kindness is my religion.
Yes.
I think that's a pretty good practice.
Yes, it's beautiful.
Myrn, thank you so much for being with us today on the new Lifeboat Hour. We wish you every success in the ways that you define success in the courageous work that you're going forward and doing. It was so good to talk with you.
Thank you, Carolyn.
And until next time, everyone, stay well, stay safe, and stay awake.
Thank you for joining us today. You can hear all podcasts and learn about Carolyn Baker's other works at www.carolynbaker.net. Her daily news digest is available by subscription and is delivered to your inbox 7 days per week with real news on economics, environment, geopolitics, civil liberties, and cultural issues, plus links to articles on inspiration and resilience. Come sail with us again next week on the Lifeboat Hour.